Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome back to Unheard. Well, normally we don't like talking about ourselves much. There are too many important and interesting things going on elsewhere in the world. But today I was at the House of Lords in Westminster attending a special parliamentary hearing on the future of news. They had invited me to come, and there we ended up talking a lot about disinformation, because over the past few months, as part of our normal routine business here at Unheard, we seem to have stumbled upon something really quite important, which is a worldwide system of censorship that crosses continents and that we think more people need to know about. So it all started last year when we decided to put adverts on our website for the first time. We have a paid subscription, which I hope you are signing up to. We also have a cafe and a members club here in London, so we have a bunch of different revenue sources, but we've never had proper ads, so we wanted to add that. And we went to three successive ad agencies, each of which were really excited about our product. We have a large audience in the UK and the US, very influential people, etc. The numbers they were expecting us to get were very significant, and each time, three successive times, we only got a tiny, tiny fraction of what was expected. And this was a real mystery. The ad agencies themselves were confused by it. Eventually, with the third agency, they revealed what they were seeing on their internal dashboards. We were using an ad agency. They then used a technical platform called Grapeshot, which is a British company that was sold to Larry Ellison's Oracle back a few years ago. And Grapeshot, in turn, then pinged something called the Global Disinformation Index, all the way up the chain, for information about quote-unquote brand safety, that is, whether or not brands would want to be associated with particular websites. It turns out we had been put on the GDI's Dynamic Exclusion List, which is basically their list of most dangerous publications that you should not go anywhere near. Obviously, we were a bit baffled by this, as was our ad agency, because we publish some of the most famous writers in the world, prize-winning authors, professors from prestigious universities. We interview politicians, pop stars, cultural icons, playwrights, all sorts of people who you really wouldn't expect would end up on the exclusion list of some organization like that. So we complained. And eventually, after weeks of waiting, we got this in response.
Our team re-reviewed the domain. The rating will not change as it continues to have anti-LGBTQI+ narratives. The site authors have also been called out for being anti-trans. Kathleen Stock is acknowledged as a prominent gender-critical feminist. She has opposed transgender self-identification in regards to proposed reforms in the 2004 UK Gender Recognition Act.
So I've got to confess, we were pretty outraged by that email. I mean, in the context of the CAS review here in the UK, which has just found that whole parts of the gender affirmation, so-called medicine treatments that were offered over the past few years to children, were under-evidenced and irresponsible. In the context of that, the importance of publishing dissenting voices like Kathleen Stock, who that email references, should be even more obvious. The GDI added further links to articles by Julie Bindle and another by Debbie Hayton, who is actually a trans woman, but who has a slightly different opinion about some of the ideology. Apparently, The GDI thinks that holding quote-unquote gender-critical beliefs, i.e. believing that biological differences are real and matter, equates to disinformation. Despite the fact, firstly, that those beliefs are now specifically protected in British law, since the Maya Forstater case we had here, it's actually enshrined in the Equalities Act that it's a protected characteristic, and it's also, polling evidence shows, held by the majority of the population. So you have a weird scenario where a self-appointed organisation is deciding that a explicitly legal and majority-held view is enough to get an entire website blocked from international ad exchanges.
I offer that as just one example, which is current because it's happening right now, and the government is paying for this organization right now. Under the umbrella term of disinformation, there's been this huge blossoming of not-for-profits, companies, and indeed government agencies that can take very politicized views on things without proper accountability, and we should try to stop that.
That's a hugely powerful example you've just given.
Until relatively recently, disinformation wasn't even a word. It first became used popularly in the 1980s as a translation or a transliteration of the Soviet concept of desinformatsa, meaning deliberate dissemination of false reports as a tool to attack somebody. It started to gain some currency in a political context in the US in the 2000s, but like so much of our current culture war, it took off in 2016 with Trump, with Brexit, and then was supercharged during the COVID years of 2020 and 21. The reason for this, if you ask someone who is implanted in the disinformation movement, will be that suddenly out of nowhere, during those years, all sorts of untrue things were being said and believed on the internet. That's how they view it. And no doubt they would say that the Trump election, the Brexit result, and probably COVID were full of this worrying disinformation. The other way of looking at it is that establishment voices being challenged during those events by opinions that they didn't hold, and yet lots of people outside the Beltway did hold, had to come up with new measures to outlaw them, to deem other opinions as somehow unacceptable. It's a way of moving what should be a political conversation into the realm of expertise and saying, no, there is an official truth here, and if you don't agree with it, you are dangerous, you're irresponsible, your voice shouldn't be heard. Now, that has been happening a lot. Let's look at the chart of Google searches. This is provided by Google for disinformation between 2016 and 2022. Well, you can see that from June to December 2016, i.e. from the beginning of the Brexit period right the way through to the election of Trump, the searches already increased fourfold. And then from 2016 to 2022, they increased 30 times. So in other words, disinformation was created as a concept during that era. In response, what you see is that corporations, big technology companies, and governments all feel, there's this thing everyone's talking about. It's officially a danger. We have to do something in response. And it creates a marketplace for enterprising people who have startups, who are commercially minded, or for people who want to have influence and build big not-for-profits that survive on government money, to suddenly say, hey, I'm a specialist in detecting misinformation and disinformation. Why don't you rely on me to go around judging whereabouts it exists on the internet? One of these organizations is the Global Disinformation Index. Let's have a look at their history. The Global Disinformation Index was founded in the UK in 2018. And its objective, as it stated at the time, was explicitly to disrupt the business model for online disinformation by starving offending publications of funding. Its two founders' CVs are, to put it mildly, straight out of central casting. Claire Melford's World Economic Forum biography states that before founding the GDI, she, quote, led the transition of the European Council on Foreign Relations from being part of George Soros's Open Society Foundation to independent status. Her co-founder, Daniel Rogers, worked apparently, quote, in the US intelligence community, we don't have any more details than that, before founding a company called Terbium Labs that uses AI and machine learning to scour the internet for illicit use of sensitive data. This he sold to Deloitte. If that all sounds a bit conspiratorial, I'm afraid it gets worse, because alongside George Soros's Open Society Foundation, which gives money to the GDI, they also receive money from the UK government via the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office, the European Union, the German Foreign Office, and a body called Disinfo Cloud, which was created and funded by the US State Department. So, just to be clear, this means the GDI is a government-funded organization. From the UK, from Europe, and from the US, taxpayer dollars are flowing to sustain this mysterious body that is deciding which media websites have a business model and which ones don't. The governments, no doubt, feel like this is a responsible thing to do because they're helping fact-checking and helping to solve disinformation. But if you look at the definition of how the GDI actually makes its decisions, things get even more interesting. When it was first founded back in 2018, they defined this term disinformation as, quote, deliberately false content designed to deceive. Now, within those very strict parameters, you could make the case that it is useful to have fact checkers calling out the most egregious offenders doing something useful for society. Personally, I think you're going to run into trouble pretty quickly, even if you go down that road, but you can see the logic. However, what they've done since 2018 is broaden the definition of what disinformation actually means. They now train both their algorithms and their researchers to look for something called, quote, an adversarial narrative. And that basically means stories that may be factually true, but which pit people against each other by attacking either an individual, an institution, or the science. It turns out that the founder of GDI, Claire Melford, gave an interview back in 2021 at the London School of Economics, where she explained all this very straightforwardly. She said,
because a lot of disinformation, as I hope I've shown, is not just whether something is true or false, it escapes from the limits of fact-checking. Something can be factually accurate, but still extremely harmful. And it leads us to a perhaps a more useful definition of disinformation, which is instantiated through these different narratives. It's not saying something is or is not disinformation, but it is saying content on this site or this particular article is content that is anti-immigrant, content that is anti-women, content that is anti-Semitic.
She explains that larger traffic websites like ours are manually rated by humans, but most are rated using automatic AI, and that they've built this so-called adversarial narrative into the AI.
And we actually instantiate our definition of disinformation, this adversarial narrative topics, within the technology. So each adversarial narrative is given its own machine learning classifier, which then allows us to search for content that matches that narrative at scale. So you'll see on the top right of this some colorful bars. These are screenshots from our internal dashboards of our technology stack. The colorful bars, each of them represent a different narrative. So you can see misogyny, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, anti-Black content, climate change denial, etc.
So it looks technical. There's lots of charts. But actually, Melford's team and her algorithm are basically looking for things that she finds offensive, that she doesn't agree with. And the result of those decisions is to defund and break the business models of those publications. When she starts listing her passion projects, the things that she herself is moved by, I'm afraid the list is somewhat predictable, including support for the January 6th insurrections, the pernicious influence of, quote, white men in Silicon Valley, and of course, anything that might undermine the global response to the existential challenge of climate change. So each of those issues, of course, she has her complete right to be moved by and think are very important. I would not challenge that. But those issues are highly contentious. People have a wide range of legitimate views on them, and they require robust, uncensored discussion if we're ever going to find good solutions for them. One way to not find those solutions is to try and centrally control a one particular narrative and shut down anyone who dissents. In the case of science, challenges to the orthodoxy are the be-all and end-all of science. You need that in order to reach good outcomes. And I'm afraid the huge failures of the official response to COVID-19 is the perfect demonstration of this. In fact, in Claire Melford's lecture that she gave at the LSE, one of the examples she handpicked to showcase the good work of the Global Disinformation Index was a particular example on a Spanish language website from June 2021 about the Delta variant of COVID-19.
This is a Spanish language site, Alerta Digital, talking about how a third of deaths in the United Kingdom from the Delta variant are amongst those people who are vaccinated, which is clearly untrue. And it's Chipotle who has been caught next to this ad unwittingly and unfortunately for them has funded this highly disinformation about vaccines.
Highly dangerous disinformation about vaccines is what Claire Melford calls it. But a little fact-checking tells a bit of a different story. The statistic being reported in that Spanish language website comes from a June 2021 Public Health England report into COVID variants that, in Table 6 on page 15, sets out the 42 known deaths from the Delta variant that happened in 2021 between January and June. Of those, it sets out 23 were unvaccinated, 7 were vaccinated with one shot, and 12 were fully vaccinated. In other words, 29%, roughly a third, were fully vaccinated, and an additional 17% were partially vaccinated, making a total, by my count, of around 45% who were vaccinated to some degree. So the headline on the Spanish language website claiming roughly a third was not inaccurate at all. If anything, it underplayed the severity of the story. The only disinformation in that example is, in fact, GDI's claim that it's untrue, which still stands uncorrected on YouTube. Examples like this are easy to find. Right there on the GDI website is a 2020 blog, still standing, unedited, no footnote, about the quote Wuhan lab conspiracy theory about the origins of COVID-19 and how cutting off ads to these fringe sites and their outer networks is the first action needed. This is still there long after Facebook and other big tech companies have even corrected their policies and conceded that the so-called lab leak theory was, at the very least, a legitimate hypothesis and should never have been censored. So where have we got to? It would be bad enough if there were mysterious, unaccountable organizations funded by government money just deciding what was true and what was not true in some kind of fact-checking operation and trying to shut people down who they disagreed with, because as I think we've demonstrated, it's very hard to have an official version of truth, and you end up shutting out important alternative viewpoints. But this is way worse, because by redefining disinformation as quote-unquote adversarial narratives, they're pretty much taking in all of journalism. I mean, look at any front page, whether it is the Daily Mirror, the Guardian, the New York Post, the New York Times. 9 times out of 10, it's pretty adversarial. And in fact, usually that's a good thing, because the official narrative needs challenging, and journalists used to think it was part of their job to be adversarial to it. So what is happening here is actually a lot more dangerous and a lot more widespread than anyone realizes. Unlike over here in the UK and in Europe, some people in the US have already started taking action against the Global Disinformation Index. Things began to get a bit worse for them in December 2022 when they put out a report that pretty much overstepped the mark, because they listed publicly their 10 most dangerous websites, the websites or publications that they think are most at risk for disinformation. And let's take a look at them. Yes, there they are. Pretty much all of them conservative leaning. Then accompanying it, they chose their least dangerous websites, the websites that were most trustworthy. And there they are, at least 9 out of 10 of them, liberal or left-leaning. In response, there have been legal cases First of all, some of these publications, including the Daily Wire and the Federalist, have teamed up with the Attorney General of Texas to sue the State Department for funding GDI and NewsGuard and similar entities that they say infringes their First Amendment rights. That's still in the courts. And separately, an initiative to prevent the Defense Department legally from using any advertiser that itself uses NewsGuard or the Global Disinformation Index or similar entities has actually been successful. It's part of federal law. But the GDI is a British company. It has a US not-for-profit and a European, but it is a British company. And a recent question in the House of Commons that was written by MP Philip Davis actually got an answer that £2.6 million was given in the period up to last year to the GDI. And that, surprise, surprise, there is still frequent contact between the GDI and the Counter Disinformation and Media Development Unit. The truth is that the Global Disinformation Index is just the tip of the iceberg. This problem is much more widespread than just one organization. And it comes down, I think, to a misunderstanding, something we've seen a huge amount of since 2016, since that populist revolt that happened in both Britain and the US, that people on the other side of it, let's call them the establishment, people who are used to being in charge, who are used to having a certain spectrum of belief, when they're challenged outside of it, they have two choices. Either they try and reach across to those people who no longer believe them and persuade them that they have good answers, engage in a genuine democratic discussion, or if they're feeling frightened, if they're feeling on the back foot, they try to just shut them down. And this is really what the whole disinformation movement is about. So if they want to improve trust, if they want to bring people together, the only way is to have a free and honest conversation about things. The role of government, if there is a role, must be to stop monopoly powers and stop enormous, highly funded tech and vested interests coalescing around a particular ideological viewpoint and trying to police it. That is the way to make it worse, not better. Private companies also have a really important role to play. If you're involved in the ad industry, or if your corporation or your company spends any money on advertising, check. Are you relying on one of these networks that itself gets partisan information from organizations like the GDI? And if so, stop using them. Are you spending your ad dollars on a wide range of websites with different political views, or are they all going to a particular collection that agree with each other? By the way, you're actually not reaching the whole population if you're doing that, so it's not even good commerce. And if you're the boss of a big organization, make sure you know what's happening further down the food chain, because quite often there will be ideological people in the lower reaches of your organization that are deliberately diverting money from that company towards particular ideological viewpoints. For example, last year, Oracle announced that it was cutting ties with the GDI precisely on free speech grounds, but they are still collaborating. Is the boss of Oracle, Larry Ellison, aware of this? And if you are an educated campaigner like Claire Melford, Claire, by the way, come on the show. You didn't respond to our request for comment, but if you want to discuss this further, we are waiting and would love to have a conversation. I believe that although you may think you're doing the world a service, in fact, what you are doing is intensifying our path towards becoming more radicalized and more divided. If you've been listening to this and would like to help, the one thing you can do is sign up. We have a paid subscription at Unheard. It costs a tiny amount, and there are lots of deals ongoing all the time, but it makes a huge difference to us. And if they try and defund us, they try and shut down the advertising, at least if we have our loyal subscriber base, we'll be fine and we can carry on challenging the narrative. Go to unheard.com/join.